this is Erica Fett. Oh, there's a tape. Hold on. God, why is this place far away? It's really unnecessary. We've got a computer back there. I don't know why we keep this stupid machine out here. This must be some secret stuff. Let's see what's even on here. The Great Santini and a Little Princess? Seriously? Maybe that's code for something. Only one way to find out.
Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
What was that thing they used to say? If it's October, it must be Saw. Was that what that was?
Sure.
I was going to say, if it's midnight, it must be double feature.
Yeah.
But that's not even
right.
That's not even true half the time.
No.
If it's 12:01, I should have put up double feature.
This show, this week, we get to say, if it's New Year's, it must be sports fans.
Yeah, right. I think that actually that phrase comes from one of the Sunday morning shows, the Chuck Todd one or something.
Okay.
What's that goddamn thing called?
I don't know.
If it's Sunday, it's... The slogan didn't work very well because I don't fucking remember.
Football?
No, that's Monday night, isn't it? They might have changed that.
I mean, sports happen all the time.
So if we're planning our calendars around slogans... Well, clearly this is why we don't do that. Now I'm going to be mad at Chuck Todd for the rest of the show until I remember what that is, which is not the point of double feature. What is the point of double feature?
The point of double feature, at least today, is to cover two films. These two films happen to be the best films ever made, which is fortunate.
Meet the press.
That we
meet the press.
Finally, okay.
If it's Sunday. With something
it must
like that.
Meet
something
the press. Like that. That's stupid.
It's Sunday. I don't know.
That is stupid. If it's the Great Santini, it must be Donald Muzzy's fault. That's what I'm going to say.
I'm Eric 13, and this is Michael Kester. We are professionals who record shows. There.
So we're doing the Great Santini. Sports fans. I'm going to say sports fans 100 times today.
I know. That was my plan, and you got there first.
The best thing about the term sports fans is that it is singular or plural, and you never change... whether or not sports fans is singular or plural. Mm-hmm. I can say it to you alone, seeing you in this window. Wait, what's that behind you?
Fuck you.
What is that?
I will murder you. I will murder you.
I can say sports fans to you.
I closed my open windows, by the way.
Anyway, Great Santini is a film that Donald Muzzy chose to put on double feature, and also Donald Muzzy supported double feature. So both of those things together seems like we got to cover the Great Santini until the 24 minute mark.
Mm-hmm.
At which point we switch over to A Little Princess, which is an Alfonso Cuarón movie.
This is a rare G-rated double feature, or a G-rated single feature on double feature anyways.
Right.
I don't know the rating of the Great Santini, but it's pretty obvious that A Little Princess is G-rated.
Right.
And that's going to be a blast to talk about.
The theme today is kind of this, I'm going to try really hard not to use the W word because of the journey this year, but it's about what happens to soldiers' lives when they're not engaged in war.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, shall we say, the war at home, right?
Yeah, we're looking at family lives
right.
in both of these and how those are kind of impacted. And I think it's a unique lens to look at that through, to use that cliche.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at this first one, we're considering a lot the damage done when the family is there as a unit.
Right.
Sure. And we'll consider a little bit different, maybe the opposite in A Little Princess.
Right.
But yeah, this is a guy who is, you know, the best of the best, the top gun, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And comes home and I think it's safe to say his home life is fucking terrible. I mean,
for those of you who follow along each week, you'll get this. The first Great Santini, this movie is kind of what what it looks like when it's the impact of on a family for the first half of Full Metal Jacket.
Mm.
And then A Little Princess is what the second half of Full Metal Jacket can do to a family.
Right, right.
This is kind of when you adopt that militaristic lifestyle and something extraneous to the military is when you bring that mentality, that idea, that rigorous, specific, planned life, and you transplant it out of the place where it was founded and insert it into a place, remove all the organic nature from it.
Right, right. When you have people in your house even addressing you
sure.
The way you would, let's say at work. I'm going to say at work instead of pretending the military is different than a job. Although this is the very thing you bring up, I think, is what makes it so different. It's surprising to watch this movie and see how much of your life the military becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have a little bit of choice in that. And thinking about the modern soldier today, the 19-year-old
sure.
soldier today, it's something that I think you can kind of leave behind to some degree. It doesn't become, you don't, you know, sleep in your uniform like this guy does. I mean, he has a right. pajama version of he wears his medals in the house, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It is so much of his life. And that's not it's not a bad thing to really have, you know, to do double feature and that's who you are.
Right.
But to, you know, basically to do your life's work somewhere and really be about that.
Mm-hmm.
Except for when you watch this movie, it really is the only thing I would say he is. I can't identify right. any other characteristic about this guy than his uniform.
It's kind of like a rampant version of that archetype of the guy who his glory days were his high school football days. And so he
sure,
kind
sure.
of just lives trapped. Man, back when I was playing football, you know, he talks about it, and that's really where he identifies his best years. You know, that's when he was the best version of himself.
Right.
This is a rampant version of that, where Robert Duvall's Santini character is so good at maybe, obviously, yeah, he's good at, you know, aerial combat, dogfighting.
Sure.
He's good at that, but he thrives in this militaristic atmosphere. And so instead of figuring out a way to swallow that, except that he has that thriving nature, he brings that home. He forces it on his family, and that's how he's at his best. That's when he's the best version of himself. And in his head, it really doesn't feel like he sees it as malicious. He's assuming that same rigmarole is going to bring out the best in his family, or at least his kids. And I don't think he realizes that, at least at the top of the movie, that he's mm-hmm. stunting a lot of the freedoms that young people need in order to grow into individuals.
Well, I also think when you're in as deep as he is, I don't know if he knows any other way to be. I think if someone really shook him and said, operate like a different kind of human, I don't think he knows what that is. I don't think he knows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could really look at this movie and go, this is a father who didn't know how to love. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that is kind of what we're looking at. It's somebody who goes into work on their off days.
Right.
They just don't know where they wander aimless without it.
Right.
So they go home and, you know, they talk to their family the way they are talked to in the military.
Sure.
The interesting question around this is, all right, so if this guy is really, he's a great pilot. Okay. Maybe he is one of the greatest pilots. This actually has a lot to do both with Top Gun, as we talked about how, what do you want to do now that you're, I want to stay here.
Yeah.
I want to,
right.
But you can do anything. You can try. No, I want to stay here. Cause that's what, you know, it's your
best, right. Yeah.
It's your comfort zone. And I think anything has the potential to do that to you, but it's interesting that the military is very predisposed to that. There's a high rate of it. But the other thing that this reminds me of is Whiplash.
Yeah.
It is somebody who is making a trade-off to be a great. And when I first saw the great Santini, I just had a kind of rage about it, about that character, right? Not about the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
it was just, oh, this is a terrible father. This is an abusive guy.
Right.
He's a prick. I
right.
don't like him. I don't see anything redeeming about this character. But that came from a place of personal hatred of war, from pacifism.
Sure.
Where I said, you know, the thing he's dedicating his life to is not good. I don't like it. Even though on a conscious level, I don't know that I'd make an argument that countries shouldn't have militaries or anything crazy like that. I could find myself there, but I don't think that's really my point. I'm just looking at his family life and going, well, that trade-off is clearly not one I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But if you abstract this and just, it's hard to back because it's war, but when it was music, when it was the arts, that's when I had an honest question. We did Whiplash on an AC, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had an honest question there of, well, if you do have to sacrifice everything in your life, but you get to go down in history as one of the greats, is that a worthy trade-off?
Right.
And I mean, I don't know, where were you on that show? Do you see a parallel here?
Well, definitely. No, I definitely do. But I feel like the contrast between the arts and the military is quite simply subjectivism. I don't think when you're looking at who is the best in the army, and we'll see this later on, spoiler alert, with the schedule, but we'll see a lot of this when we cover American Sniper in The Journey. Mm-hmm. But what makes an individual in the military a great individual in the military?
Sure.
I feel way more comfortable comparing this to something like sports because there are stats, you know, that are considered valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the overarching thing is not necessarily the statistics at any given sample time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you got the most home runs in a season. I'm going to mix sports analogies because sports fans,
I didn't even realize you were doing that.
Yeah. So it's not,
it's embarrassing.
It's not that you got the most home runs in a season. It's that you won 6 NBA championships in a row.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be that you're the MVP. It's that you're consistently an MVP.
Right.
And I think that when you're looking at something like art, the subjectivism is so much broader. It's okay for me to say something like, I don't really like the Beatles. It's true. I don't really like the Beatles. I think that's okay because the Beatles did a thing, and it's hard for me to argue that everything I actually like isn't predicated on the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas when you're talking about something like sports or the military, the legacy starts and ends with when you're there, and the subjectivism, you're not a giant on which one can stand.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right, right.
One doesn't come in after Santini dies and picks up where he left off.
Yeah.
They don't take the torch.
Sure.
And so to be one of the greats feels way, and this is my point, I'm sorry for taking this route, but my point is that to be one of the greats in a Whiplash setting feels way more enduring and necessary because people will take the torch from you and it'll transcend your life and your style. Whereas in the military, what, your plaque goes on a wall.
Yeah. I mean, I think future people in the military could look to, you know, they could aspire to be you, but I see your point that the fact that you were there doesn't necessarily make them, they're not really building up. Well, look at, okay. So what about like a presidency though? Right. So there is something where you clearly have to make, I assume that the family sacrifices a president makes are 100% worse than we think they are. I think probably basically never sees his family ever. I can't imagine. Maybe that's not true. Maybe a bit. But you know, when you do something like that, president is an important job. It's certainly a legacy. It is something that I think you could argue would be built off of. You know, you are going to mm-hmm. implement.
Definitely.
And
pick up where
sure,
the other left
sure,
off.
Sure, sure.
Torch passing.
Yeah, definitely. And so there is a sacrifice that's just sort of required there. But you could make a bit of that argument for almost anything. The idea of a work-life balance or of having a family life and striving to do something else, a musician who's always on the road, never sees their kids, or really anybody, you know, I see this in LA all the time because film hours are insane, and just people having relationships, having anything steady in their life is, it looks a lot different than it has other places I've lived. And I don't know where the right thing to do lies. Because if you're going to be diehard military like this, it's going to have an impact on other humans, on quite a few other humans.
Sure.
In this position.
Yeah.
If you want to do that yourself, the idea of, is that a good idea or not? To throw yourself wholly into something and have no other aspect to your life. I mean, that's a personal decision you got to make and a hard one, but you know, whatever, man, that's on you. But when you have a family like that, look at the pain and torture his family goes through. Their whole lives revolve around him. Even his funeral is not about them. It's a military funeral. His one tombstone, the same size, shape, and soldier among soldiers as everyone else. And his family goes through the lengths of, you know, don't cry, get that out in your, that's your personal garbage. You have to be strong for the military. It's like his first family is the military, and it's also his only family.
Right. Do you think that when you look at the individuals in his family, mainly his son, I mean, right? That's the person we get the most insight into. Would you argue that, and I mean, it could go either way, but do you think that his son ends up being such a redeemable person because of him or in spite of him?
Well, it's hard, right? Because of a multitude of factors. First is, I don't know that I can necessarily agree with the premise. I think there's instances where he makes the right choice, and there's also instances where he struggles. And actually, maybe to find where I sit on that, the instances where he struggles is where he's being like his father actually is. You know, when he makes an ass of himself drinking, not that it's the end of the world or anything, but you see a lot of his dad in that. And when he checks that kid under pressure for a sports fan game, that is, again, you know, pretty much at the instruction of his dad. But there's also something interesting about when he rushes to be there for his token black friend, secret secondary double feature today, secret tertiary theme today, maybe. Needs to only be pointed out. I don't know if the movies say anything about it. Maybe we'll discover that next film. I have no fucking clue. But he rushes there to be there for his friend, and he is reamed out by his father. He says he's just trying to do what his dad would have done. And so the opinions that he is really making more himself, he's going, okay, well, if my father's a great man, then he would want to go do this. And his father's going, you actually got that answer wrong. What I would have done is fall in line, because you're supposed to fall in line.
Yeah.
So I think it's in spite of, I think maybe he has, just from society, he knows the right answers. Maybe he's born with a code of values. And like we sometimes talk about how, you know, right and wrong does not come from religion. It's with every person.
Right.
People without religion also know right and wrong. I think for him, it doesn't come from his dad at all.
One of the most strong pieces of insight you get in his father is when he shows up to work, quote unquote, that first day, and his superior officer, to paraphrase, says, I don't like you, you're a loose cannon. If I could have my way, I'd bust your ass down to sergeant so fast it would make your head spin.
Mm-hmm.
But until you slip up, I can't do that. That whole time, he's got this smug smile and he never rebels. He never, like you said, when the question arises, what would you have done? His answer is fall in line. Even when his superior officer goes, I don't like you, he says, sir, yes, sir. He says it with a smug face, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't,
sure.
He doesn't break formation.
Hide a donut in his locker, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that
you're looking for that.
I know. I was trying to figure that out. Right. Too.
Yeah. I'm worried that as we take such consideration of war on double feature this year, that by the time we get to the end, I will still have made no mental progress on understanding the military better, or
yeah.
I was going to say feeling better about it, but even just having a better understanding of
sure
such a different kind of life. I reject fall in line so much that it just...
I feel like it speaks to us on that level, though, where because I think you have this kind of... You see the timeline shift, the generational shift. Santini is of the generation where you've done the family proud by joining the military, whereas his son is way more closer to our generation where... And I don't know. I mean, I can't speak directly about... you know, everyone in our generation. But I know if I came to family or friends and said, hey guys, I joined the military.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Their reaction may not be positive. Mm-hmm. Their reaction may be quizzical and they may question whether or not I really knew what I was getting into. It wouldn't be, oh my God, I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. Well,
for supporting the nation. They'd be like, oh my God, are you fucking out of your mind? You just threw your entire life away.
Especially during wartime. Right. I mean, yeah. That...
Which is all time.
I saw... I know.
Where time is all time.
I know, but when there was a big push right after 9/11 to get more people in the military because we were killing them too fast, we needed to, like, you know, add more. I remember seeing that for the first time, mm-hmm. seeing the reactions right. to yeah. people deciding to go. And in the place I lived, I'm sure that still exists in Arizona and many places that people are listening to this going, are you crazy? It's the most honorable thing.
Oh, yeah.
But mm-hmm. to provide the counterexample of that, in some places it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are generally the hippie, liberal, progressive type places. That changes our interpretation of the film too, though. It changes when this film was made, and maybe even to look at it today from a lot of places, I think it might have a different message. When we get to the end scene and the family packs up in their van and drives away and the credit music gets oddly uplifting, I think to myself, was this a cautionary tale? Was this... Because they never resolve their relationship.
Sure.
They never... It's but not like...
I think the idea there is... He picks up or his dad leaves off.
There's certainly that. It just seems...
He starts singing the same songs and...
Up to the end, things at home were bad, you know, and things weren't resolved. And that's what feels like caution. I say bad. I dismiss that so out of hand because it's just like, you know, I think I made the case for maybe it's good to dedicate your life to something or whatever. But I almost want to say with every great sacrifice comes... punching your wife, because it does just kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It also seems like there is a high rate of domestic abuse associated with these things. And that's what, I mean, in my heart of hearts, I can't go, yeah, the right thing to do is to seize greatness, punch your wife. I just don't think, I can't really sit here and go, well, on the one hand, he beat his wife, but on the other hand, he flew a jet pretty good. I don't know how to transition from that to a little princess. Something about alcoholism, maybe.
Sure. Or abuse, you know, whatever. You pick a thing.
Something in that. Can I tell you, I don't know if we're going to hit on this at all, but I have to say, just for my own little satisfaction, there is a scene in A Little Princess that I think is a landmark scene of all the scenes we've ever seen in double feature and will always stand out to me as just this insane moment. A YouTubeable moment of Nicolas Cage punching out a bear type scene. The most absurdly devastating moment in any film of all time. I mean, she's told her dad dies.
Uh-huh. Oh, the balloon. Is this the balloon?
And you're homeless and you have no money. And I love the way she says it to her too. You're penniless. without any money. like to really drill it in. I realize, you know, G movie, kids are watching it, really got to hit the point, but it's beyond cartoonish. It is a level of unnecessary cruelty that is insane. And after she goes through this list of just trying to build the worst day possible, she goes, and your only salvation rests on the person who just gave you a laundry list of dickish things, me. Also, you might be an orphan, depending on my mood, and I'm kind of a bad person. Anyways, go wash the floor. And it is just such an outrageously, like, why do you have to be so fucking mean? I realize you're the antagonist, but settle down, lady.
I definitely feel like Miss Minchin is one of the most evil people we've seen on Double Feature.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Since like Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, it's Cruella De Vil style.
Right.
Evil tree.
She is so, there's so much about her character in this movie where she's just mean. Just mean to be mean. I mean, she just has rules that she comes up with rules. It's almost situations arise and somebody speaks at dinner and she goes, hey, here we go. New rule.
Right.
No speaking at the table ever. Never, ever speak at the table. We don't do that. And what's so devastating about her character is that she is the only character in power the entire time. You never once have another character in power other than Miss Minchin. Her sister's weaker than her. All the faculty is weaker. You see all the teachers who seem marginally redeemable, if not entirely preoccupied by sausage, don't have any sway in this establishment.
Yeah.
The only thing that Miss Minchin seems to pay attention to is finances and making sure the little girl's parents are paying on time.
Well, and to that idea, she's not the only agent of change. You do have the incredible scene where for some reason Vincent Schiavelli comes in to deliver bad news, which is just, I miss Vincent quite a bit. I would have loved to live in a world where you always get bad news from him.
Oh,
he just goes door to door and just
so good.
That's unfortunately a film that was never made, but should have been.
Damn it.
I know.
I was just, you know, we hit the same place at the same time.
Oh, well.
I feel like the thing about this movie, the strength of this film is, I mean, I guess it's just that. It's finding, it's the idea that all girls are princesses. But I think what they're saying there is that each, in this specific instance, each of these girls has these intrinsic high value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you're going through this film and there's a person strategically placed in a movie whose sole job it is to go, you have no value, yeah, literally,
right.
You're penniless, you have no money.
right. You're penniless without value.
Yeah.
And you have no money to prove it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and then on top of that, when Miss Minchin, when she runs out of money and she goes, well, fortunately for you, I have a heart and you can work here as long as you speak to no one.
Right.
Oh, and give me your fucking necklace for no reason. Just because it seems like you find joy in that.
It's almost like an improv thing.
Yeah.
The scene's just kind of falling a little dead there. And she goes, I feel like I should be more dickish. Is there something else here I haven't stripped you of everything. Necklace. Yes, that looks, give me that too.
Right.
Yeah, just the ultimate fucking bully. And it's fun to watch how a character is such a, I'd go beyond saying not realistic, but just nonsensical character.
Right.
How other adults interact with her. And right. Just seeing the totally. Sort of, because as an audience, we go, this is insane. You're mm-hmm. twirling a mustache you don't even have.
Right.
And then, you know, I'm not going to look to the little girls to define that, because this could definitely be seen as the sort of extreme end caricature of how evil's represented in their mind. But I do turn to the adults and go, hey, you guys, what's up with that lady? What do we know what her deal is? And they seem to have this reaction that is like they've accepted it a long time ago too. That they just kind of go, I mean, when writing this or when acting it out, that would have been the most insane thing for me to try and figure out is how do the other adults react to this woman? They're just, oh, she's interrupting my nap.
Yeah.
Oh, I really don't think that's a good idea. You always shoot me down. So there's just some sort of sad apathy to it.
It's definitely one of those things that to talk about this movie as a G-rated movie and then to talk about it that way as a movie specifically, G-rated movies, while they're not exclusively for children, let's be honest, they're for kids, right? That's why you make a movie G-rated.
But when, I would say they're for dollars and however you can magnet those away. Although I don't know enough about that world. There's probably a lot of passion in that somewhere.
I think...
I don't know.
With A Little Princess, this film... So there's this thing. There's this thing that happens. We talk about it all the time with G-rated movies, specifically, more specifically with these current CG, DreamWorks, Pixar type movies.
Right.
It's that thing that people say when they go, oh, you know, it's for kids, but there's some adult humor. It's for the adults too.
Uh-huh.
And I mock that all the time because I think it's stupid. If you're an adult, if you can't get the same jokes that kids get, you're an idiot. That's what I think. I mean, we talked about this on the AC. So to look at A Little Princess, while it's G-rated and there are no tits, there is no fucking, and nobody says fucking or tits.
Uh-huh.
While you're following younger characters, the stakes are about as high as they get. And it's very dark, maybe not dark, bleak.
Yeah.
And to go further, I would definitely say that this movie is way, I mean, I saw this as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to hate watching it. My sister loved this movie and I hated it because it was a fucking bummer.
Yeah.
But I think that this movie has something about it that adults can't understand. I think that it performs at a level where when Sarah and Becky wake up and they're in an Indian palace in the attic,
mm-hmm.
A child sees that scene and that part of the movie and a child goes, oh my God, this is magic. Look at all this stuff. Everything is so good now.
Yeah.
An adult looks at it and immediately starts riddling the consequences. They start going, where did this, what if Miss Minchin comes in here? No, you have to hide literally all of this. Also, where did this come from? Wasn't that creepy guy across the street? Also, hey, let's talk about the fact that just because you're eating a hot meal, that doesn't change the fact that she's totally manipulating you. This is not a fair one-to-one trade, Sarah. I don't think you understand what's going on here. And the tone...
You're describing my entire mental path as watching this movie.
It's
that's me.
This amazing thing when you watch this movie. I think Alfonso Cuarón takes you can look at it one way or the other, but he and Robert Rodriguez take the same page where they go, I mean, it's G-rated, but it's not for adults. It's just not. It's a movie for kids that operates in this childlike mindset. It's not where one-to-one doesn't have to feel like justice. It just has to feel fair.
Yeah.
And I think because I remember as a kid thinking that scene was so much the crux of the turning point. Hey, maybe things are okay. And watching it this time as an adult, seeing that and going, this is not even close to coming back to where things are just or even level.
Right.
And even so much that goes all the way to the end of the movie where Sarah and her father are reunited and we're led to believe that something terrible happens to the orphanage where all the girls are okay, but Miss Minchin becomes a chimney sweep.
Right. Also, black people have equal rights now.
Right.
Post-World War I. That just happened somewhere between the scenes.
And I'm sitting there seeing Miss Minchin as a chimney sweep. And she's still being a cunt to the little boy. And I'm thinking to myself, did you learn nothing from all of this? I don't feel vindicated in any way.
I don't even know how you get that far. I stop as she's a chimney sweep. Like my brain malfunctions there. But I do think watching this, that it strikes me so much as a kid's movie that I have trouble even believing that anybody watched it. Like, it just seems so crazy to me that I can't imagine living in a world where this is like a 99% Rotten Tomato, everybody loved 5 stars. And I'm looking at this going, but it's insane. But this is, and this is the Salvador Dali made this movie. I don't understand.
Really benchmarks this for double feature is the fact that I totally agree. The petroleum jelly slathered on the lens and the horrible CG Hydra, the fact that Liam Cunningham is blue for part of the movie. All of this just seems like, how could anybody have taken this seriously, let alone everybody thought that this was a fantastic achievement? Then I think of a film called Gravity. We're going to pass Children of Men, because anybody who listens to Double Feature obviously knows our affection for Children of Men now.
Mm-hmm.
But Gravity is a perfect example of this same type of filming. It's so much a time capsule and so resonant at the spark, but the half-life of these movies, I feel like when you really truly capture these emotions and the feelings of the zeitgeist that the film comes out, like using Gravity as an example, assuming everybody has seen Gravity, but it's the same director. It's Alfonso Cuarón.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like what's the cliche? The flame that burns twice as hot burns half as long.
Brightest. Right.
And yeah. I feel like that's what you see with A Little Princess, or maybe even a movie like La La Land. I feel like in another 10 years, people are going to look back at Gravity or La La Land and go, what? Why would we nominate this for an Academy Award?
Right. The fetus imagery is too obvious. Is that?
Right. Exactly.
We'll all be hip to that. Yeah.
Not to not Gravity or La La Land. I love La La Land.
It's so strange to look at the... You can see Alfonso Cuarón, but you can also, mm-hmm. I think you can see Lubinsky, the cinematographer in this movie. And I had to look that up. It was so funny watching this and going, you know, this is filmed in a way that's really dated, but the technique is really amazing. Like the way everything tracks extremely delicate and slowly. There's never a moment of a jostle or a crazy move, or it's all just very concentrated and a lot of thought goes into it and focused. And I looked and it's Lubinsky, and that's just so funny to me because his camera work has been remarkable in all of these, almost, I mean, hand in hand with the director. You know, people know his name, and I think Children of Men, we spent a lot of time way back talking about camera work and the crazy long takes and the camera going in and out of a car and all this insane stuff. And then also watching it and separating that from the G-rated script, which is the crazy part to me, and the characters. And then looking at the sets and the world, which is another, I think that's it's a third leg of the stool that, I mean, stool is a bad metaphor because the legs aren't attached to the base. They're crazily, these are three legs to different stools that somehow came together and made a movie that at the time was, you know, the gift of G-rated movies. And that's the fact that we're dealing with an adaptation that, you know, takes place during World War I in a boarding house. I mean, I can only imagine the target audience for this is the age and gender of the main characters.
Sure.
And I'm thinking to myself...
And race.
Right. Right.
Let's not be too... Right.
Not be too progressive there.
Let's not pass over that because, well, just keep in mind, you're talking about a wealthy white family.
Sure.
who lived in India.
Sure.
And now...
Well, also India kind of seems like a crazy part of this too.
Well, not for the English.
Sure.
But yeah.
Well, I can see it all on paper. I can see it in a story, in a fable. But then seeing on screen, we move from the craziest levels of... I mean, it's very cultural India. It's right. not we happen yeah. to be in India.
It's not a military family in India as we know it, you know?
Yeah.
It's not.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned.
On the base with the McDonald's and right. sometimes we have to venture out.
Inexplicably painted blue. You know, it's that level of Indian. And then to move to this boarding house and to move into these fantasy sequences, there's almost nothing that is... that strikes that chord of that ties the young white princess audience to the movie, except for the young white princess. And that's different to me than now when we think of kind of how the genre changed. If I think about, okay, female dominated film, you know, all very young girls, that's the target audience. I don't know how old the girls are in this. I'm terrible at that. But what, like 8 or something? Is that?
Sure. Somewhere between 8 and 16.
Okay. So let's say 10. Let's just go with 10.
Yeah. They're probably, yeah.
And to try and think of what is the demo? What is the genre for the 10-year-old girl look like today? I don't really know if things like this film exist at all anymore. I think the closest we get is the kind of Inside Out, you know, young girl animated. Do we see a pack of 10-year-old girls in films anymore, leading films? It's kind of crazy.
The thing to keep in mind dealing with children's movies is that the really children's movies, like Oogie Loves...
is a phrase that I've never heard before. Is that what you're...
Yeah, well, check out Christopher Lloyd's filmography. there's a place now where children are... And I don't want to get into this conversation specifically, but...
Well, good. We have a couple minutes left and that you
children
should...
Children are raised by something called Netflix, right? So we have this whole thing where really you don't bring kids to the theater anymore. If you do, it's for a film like what I was saying, something the whole family can enjoy, and also something that costs hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
Has to be designed by committee.
Got to hit all four of our quadrants here.
So I think I would argue, and the closest thing I can say, and this is on the other end of the spectrum, but the closest thing that I've seen this year, and I've seen a lot of movies, the closest thing I've seen to something as specifically tailored as A Little Princess is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows.
Oh, sure, sure.
It is a movie that doesn't make any goddamn sense to me as an adult. But if, as Michael Bay often says, if I were a 14-year-old boy, I would have loved every minute of it, and
right.
I would have bought all the toys.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that mystify me, you know, looking at these movies now comes as a detachment from just, I'm not able to name 10 things in this genre. So I suddenly wonder if it exists.
Right.
Because we live...
Twilight, maybe.
Well,
right?
that's what was interesting to me is I feel like if I had to name, if we weren't having this conversation, you just said, hey, could you name a couple of movies you think would appeal to a 10-year-old girl? I would think, oh, movies starring 14-year-old girls. You know, movies about high school romance and the things they're looking forward to doing later in life. And the, you know, you could get into all these mental ideas of girls looking up to being an older age and trying to...
Isn't there some movie about some magic mermaids? H2O Just Add Water. It's a TV show. H2O Just Add Water was an Australian series about mermaids with magic powers.
I don't know where that came from, but I'm glad you have that. No, I'm thinking more in the Freaky Friday vein of, wouldn't it be nice if I were 21 when you're 10? You know what I mean?
Right.
Even that girl is older than 10, so I don't know. But seeing it, it now has this bat to the face effect of, hey, imagination, that still exists. Hey, you know, you forgot about it. The same thing we talk about with Rodriguez. to see the sort of I'm not worried about cleaning this magic mess up level of imagination, the getting dirty, but not hey, don't get too much dirt on. This is a nice shirt. I paid a lot of money for it. You know, just the whole world open where anything could happen, even if it's CG monsters in the 90s. It was like 95 or something. That is so rare we get to this level of double feature. And I go, we've just never even gotten close to this.
Yeah, nothing close.
And it's a movie that, you know, is this popular.
Yep.
We're not diving deep into the obscurity. We're doing a little princess. And I'm going, wow, we've just never done this before. Crazy. Maybe when we did The Lion King. I think that's probably the closest we got.
Right.
And you can find that on doublefeature.fm, assuming that it's not so old that it disappeared into the ether. And are those on iTunes yet? What's going on there? Anyways, you can ask on Twitter. It's at Pling Michael. You want to ask those technical questions about where is everything? Why is it taking so long?
Yeah.
And we're going to be doing two more movies for adults next time.
There's some stuff for kids in here.
There is stuff for kids. Let me rattle off the names of several kids right now. That is David B. Anderson, Greg Winter, and Shore, Kimberly Ants, Debbie Starin, Meta Somerville, David Koch, and Lexi Love. Actually, the age range on our executive producers is all over the fucking map. So that's exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Double feature demographic. I don't know. Could be anybody.
I don't know what that was. There's so many years of this show. Maybe it's one of those inside jokes no one gets. Oh. That reminds me. Next week there's finally a thing to talk about. Like a top secret thing. I can't say anything about it right now, but it's like a bridge. Like, if inside jokes were water, it would be like a bridge over them. That connects things for the gap. You know, like Shadows of the Empire? I mean, technically, I guess that's non-canonical anymore, but I think the comparison still works. Yeah, now I'm definitely saying stuff about this not supposed to do that. Okay, wait. I've got a total radio transition for this. Hey, you know what else has a lot of years? Suicide Girls. 15 years. Happy anniversary. Damn it, the movies, I forgot. This whole thing is out of order. Let's see. What were those again? Okay. All right, next time it's Intolerable Cruelty. And How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days? Man, I hope someone's making sure these guys are okay. I can't tell what's going on in there anymore. Okay, so back to Suicide Girls. This has been Erica Fett, but listen, you have to do this a specific way. You can't just guess this. This has been Fecta Suicide. See? Told you. The website is suicidegirls.com. PHECDA. Go look. I'm also on Twitch, Instagram, Patreon, the internet, Twitter. They're all linked up there, actually. It's at Erica Fett. All right. I'm actually going to go back and check with the boys. Good luck with whatever you do with these recordings. Listen to them, I guess. Watch more fucking film.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.